You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
It's a sunny day today. Yes. I was walking back here up the small hill. I was enjoying the nice weather. How are you enjoying it so
far?
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Turning out to be a good summer, if a little bit hot. And we've got lots of interesting science today. When looking through these stories, I mean, they were just absolutely crazy to me. I don't know which one I'm most excited for, but we'll start off at the start with this green gel.
Yeah, no, this week's got a good collection, I think. So I read the story and I thought of glowing green eyes, which I thought was very appropriate given we've just had Halloween. And what it is, it's about cataracts, right? So if you've observed in people who've gotten a bit older that sometimes their eyes get a bit cloudy, and it's basically what happens with age, you can get your lens and your eye becomes cloudy and your vision deteriorates.
Yeah.
But it's not actually a problem so much anymore, because you can, doctors can do cataract surgery, and basically they remove that cloudy lens and they put in an artificial one. And this is pretty standard surgery now, like it happens a lot all around the world.
Yep.
But when they're doing this, they need to inject a clear hydrogel so that you can keep the eye inflated and protect the cornea so that you don't damage it, right? And so the hydrogel is just like a really watery gel.
Yeah.
And it's clear so that they can kind of see what they're doing. And then they have to remove it once they finish the surgery. But because it's clear, it can be really hard to tell where it is.
Right.
And if you don't, it increases the pressure in the eye. And so that can be kind of painful. And then over time, you could actually cause some vision loss, which is not good, given you had the cataract surgery too. So what this group have done is, they've previously tried just adding a dye to this hydrogel so that it's a coloured, and so that they typically, what they'll do is they'll use a blue light and they want to see it better and where it is. But in their previous efforts, what happened was the dye leaked out of the gel and spread into the eye, so they couldn't then tell what was the gel and what was the eye anymore because the dye colour was everywhere.
Right.
So what they've done now is they've, with this hydrogel, they've actually chemically bound fluorescent molecule to it called fluorescein.
Yep.
And then so now what you can do is, if you do your surgery, you take out where you think the gel is, you shine a blue light on it, and where the gel still is will glow green.
Very convenient.
And so you can see if you've still got some there or not.
Well, what if you have green eyes?
Oh, yeah, that's true. What if you have green eyes?
I guess I hadn't actually thought of that. So good point. I imagine that the what is causing the fluorescence, like the green pigment of your green eye colour, is probably not as fluorescent as this.
Fluorescent. Right, that makes sense.
So you won't glow. But good point. And so it has completely just been in the lab. Like they've just taken pig lenses and they've put the gel on it to see what happens. And so a lot of work to go. But what's really exciting is everything they used is already clinically used.
Right.
So it's known to be safe.
So it shouldn't take too long if they're testing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, really interesting. Then this next one really just it blew me away. Rats sniffing out contraband fauna. How the hell is this even working?
So I love the story of these rats. They're called the African pouched rats, or sometimes they're called the Gambian pouched rats. And for the biologically inclined, yes, they're not a true rat. They're part of what's called the African moroid rodent group.
But do they look like rats?
Yeah, they look like rats.
Yeah,
so we'd all call them rats.
Yeah.
They're widespread, just a couple of details about them. They're widespread in sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. And like the biggest ones can actually get to 0.9 metres, including the tail. And the tail's half their length. So even the body's not that big. But they can be quite, they're not like the rats we get here. They're a bit bigger.
Yeah.
And they have really poor eyesight. So they rely on smell and sound to get around and sensing and stuff. And so I first learnt of these rats through what were called the hero rats and the specific rat called Magoa. And what happened in the 1990s is there was a Belgian charity called Apopo that began sponsoring and training these rats to detect landmines.
Wow.
Yeah, and this specific rat, Magoa, was it had a 5-year career in Cambodia.
That's pretty long for a rat, right?
Yeah, and it lives, they do, so I think this rat lived 7 or 9 years. Mm. So it actually got to retire.
Yeah, wow.
Which I just love.
In the landmine industry as well.
Exactly.
Pretty dangerous, right?
Right, mm. Right. And so in its 5-year career, it found 71 landmines and 38 unexploded ordnances. The range that it cleared varied a bit, but did actually receive a medal from the UK in 2020. it's called a PDSA gold medal.
Yeah.
And it's a medal they give out to like hero animals. And it was the first time a rat won.
Was it like a rat-sized medal?
They do have a picture of a little rat. I don't know if it was actually Mugawa with the little medal off, but yeah, I just always remember hearing about these rats that were clearing landmines, and you know, like it is, they're small, they get in lots of places where we can't, or dogs can't, and they're a bit cheaper to train than dogs. With landmines, they were small enough that they weren't triggering stuff, and so they've been really great in this sphere. There is some research that's also gone on about, can they sense the bacteria that cause tuberculosis? Because obviously TB is a big problem in Africa. And now they're looking at, can we use these rats to send out illegally traded wildlife parts?
Yeah.
And so they were specifically in the study looking at elephant ivory, rhino horn, African blackwood, which is not actually, that's a tree, and pangolin scales.
Right.
Pangolin turns out is the most most widely traded of these sort of illegal trading.
Oh,
animals.
Wow.
It's quite surprising.
Mm.
Yeah.
Maybe because there's more of them or less protection from poachers?
Yeah, I guess so. Probably, right? Because you think, you know, with elephants and rhinos, they're big, there's been a lot of work around protecting them, whereas the pangolin's not so big.
Yeah,
and,
that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know what people want it for. But yeah, and so they've basically trained these rats to try and scent these things. It's actually quite hard to train a rat, you can imagine. You've got to first teach it to actually hold its nose to the scent for a few seconds so that it can actually smell. And then you've got to train it, What is the target? So is it elephant ivory? Is it rhino horn? And what's just the other stuff? Because what traffickers will do, it turns out, is they'll put things in coffee beans or washing powder, highly scented things, to try and cover up the smells.
Yeah.
And so basically, they in the lab, they've trained. They started with 11 rats, but 3 got sick during the training, so they ended up with 8. And these 8 rats could actually identify these 4 target specimens from within 146 targets. So there was a lot of non-targets, and so they could differentiate.
Right.
And so, yeah, they need to still take them out into the field, see how that goes.
But looking very effective.
Looking very effective, and they even went on to a step of making the rats a little vest. So you can look it up online, it's really cute. They've got these little red vests that have a little ball at the front. So the idea is that with the training, when they scent the target, so these illegal wildlife parts, they'll pull that ball and it lets out a little beep, and so then their handler knows where to go to find them.
Oh, so a little bit independent there, self-sufficient. Wow.
Yeah. So it's really cool.
Yeah, incredible stuff with these rats. And then lastly here, parrot feathers. How do they work?
Yeah,
what's going on?
Okay, so if you've ever been to Auckland Zoo through the kia enclosure, and you see sometimes you'll see the kia kind of fly over and their wings spread out, and there's this beautiful orange underneath, right? That's, parrots are really interesting in the way they get those really bright oranges and reds and yellows.
Yeah.
And that's what this study was about. So in nature, colour is either structural or pigmentation. Structural colour is when there is some sort of nanostructure or periodic structure on the feather barbules or on beetles on their back and stuff.
Right.
So if you think of a tui that's quite iridescent, you know, like you kind of get that blue black when it's in certain light, that's structural colour.
Right. Okay.
Then you get pigments. So that's chemistry, right? There's a molecule in there that gives it that colour. So often that will be carotenoids, which are like the things that make carrots orange, or in birds you have the hihi that's got a bit of yellow.
Right.
So that's carotenoids, and they get that from their diet. The blacks, browns, and greys are from a molecule called melanin. And then parrots are really interesting because they have their own unique pigment system called sitica fulvins.
Bit of a mouth.
It's really interesting spelling on the word too. And so if you think about the kakapo, which is that kind of green,
yep.
that's actually structural colour from blue, but with a yellow pigment in there as well. So you get the green. Oh,
so it's kind of those two different ways of getting the colour kind of working
together. Yeah, exactly, right? And so because parrots are unique in using these acidificants for colour, there's been a lot of study on it. And so a while ago, what was found was that there's an enzyme called PKS that makes the red. And this red is unique in that it has some chemistry that's called an aldehyde to it. And then what these researchers were interested in was, well, how do you get the yellow, right? And so they studied, they took two types of birds. One's called a dusky lory, which is a parrot that can be red or it can be yellow. And they took rosy-faced lovebirds, which have green and red feathers. And so basically what they're trying to see is what's going on with the yellow feathers in these birds.
Yeah, how does it happen?
How does it happen? And so they did chemistry and they did genetic analysis. And what they found was there's this one enzyme that's a lot more active in the yellow feathers. And they called it ALDH3A2.
Very creatively named.
Yep. Right. And it's more active. And so they're going, okay, this is the enzyme that's doing something to give us the yellow. And what it turns out is it just changes the chemistry on the red pigment from this aldehyde to what's called a carboxylic acid. So it's kind of a small change and you get yellow. And so what they were finding is then also because you can change the ratio of how much of the aldehyde one there is to the carboxylic acid, so the how much of the red to the yellow, so you can get, you know, your scale of colour. And so red and yellow in equal amounts give you your orange.
Yeah, so we're able to reverse engineer these colours now, I guess, if we had those chemicals on hand.
Yeah, and so, people can isolate them and stuff.
And do you know if it works similarly to how we develop other colours in terms of paints and dyes and that sort of thing?
It depends on the pigment type as to how it changes. So with carotenoids, what you'll get is they have a carbon chain that has like a single bond, double bond, and that length can change. Or the groups on the end of those chains change. So it's not quite the same.
But we're getting somewhere. Does this have any ramifications for how we look at those sorts of colours, or is it mostly looking at the birds?
It's mostly for fulvins is just looking at the birds and better understanding what they are. And because they don't know why the parrots have this different system, they have some theories, so they're still looking into it, but they think maybe it's because it's a more durable colour pigment, right? Like they stay that colour, whereas with carotenoids, often the birds have to keep eating it to keep it bright and colourful. And that's how you can, for some species, you can tell the bird's healthy or, you know, like it's, the male bird's a good bird to mate with because it's really brightly coloured because it's had a good diet.
So some evolutionary purpose there. Wow, that's really interesting. All right, well, thank you for coming in today, Kushla. Thank you, Mota, as always, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the bee.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.